Today is Tuesday, April 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. Justice Department announces another investigation into a major police department after officers killed a woman in her own home last year.
To determine whether LMPD engages in a pattern or practice of violations of the Constitution.
Plus a new challenge for the anti-COVID AstraZeneca vaccine. And Australia launches a new investigation into the deaths of Indigenous people while in police custody. We'll have these stories and more next. For the second time in a week, the U.S. Justice Department is opening a sweeping probe into a big city police department. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
After George Floyd's death, the department started looking into the tactics of Minneapolis police. Now it will probe Louisville's department after police killed Breonna Taylor during a raid at her home last year.
To determine whether LMPD engages in a pattern or practice of violations of the Constitution or federal law.
Attorney General Merrick Garland says it'll focus on whether Louisville police engage in a pattern of unreasonable force. Chief Erica Shields says she welcomes the investigation, and so should her officers.
They understand that whatever we've been doing isn't working.
Taylor's family reached a $12 million settlement with the city over her death. Sagar Magani, Washington.
America's top general in Afghanistan says the U.S. military has begun closing down, and Afghanistan's security forces must be ready to take over. The drawdown is scheduled to be completed by September 11, 2021, 20 years to the day after the attacks that prompted the military action. Speaking to reporters on Monday, Pentagon Press Secretary Adam Kirby explained what role American service members may have following the withdrawal.
We will continue a measure of financial support. And one of the things that we want to look at is their contractual needs and the degree to which they are still going to require, particularly aviation maintenance support. And I think that's primarily what General McKenzie was referring to. So, yes, they have been in touch. He is expecting General McKenzie to come back before the end of the month, by the end of the week, with an adjusted, revised drawdown plan and also looks for the general's recommendations as well as those of General Milley, too, their recommendations about contractual support going forward.
Recently, Pakistan's president, Arif Alvi, sat down with VOA's Aisha Tanzim to discuss the impact on the region of the United States military withdrawal from Afghanistan and how Pakistan sees its future relationship with its neighbor.
I think it is a very important announcement. I think this is the region has been looking forward to some settlement, and the Doha talks came to a culmination with an agreement on withdrawal of U.S. forces. I think that's the right direction to go, and I am sure that that this withdrawal also relates to the fact that there should be an agreement between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan for what is going to happen in the future. Because we want stability. The people of Afghanistan want for stability. Leave aside what Pakistan wants. Pakistan wants stability on its borders, because any instability or any insurrection of any sort is going to hurt us. It has always done so. So therefore, we are looking forward to a very stable and peaceful Afghanistan. And a lot of nitty-gritties have to be handled and settled. But I believe the future government of Afghanistan would be a peaceful government.
You mentioned the second part of the agreement, which should be the intra-Afghan negotiations between Taliban and the Afghan government and other Afghan factions. They don't seem to be going very well, though.
I think that is very important. Therefore, the efforts of the government of the United States, the efforts of Pakistan, the efforts of China, which is bordering Afghanistan, to the effort of Russia and the effort of Iran. All these countries are important in trying to stabilize, in trying to, even Iran, in trying to come encourage an agreement between the people of Afghanistan and the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban.
You mentioned a lot of countries. All of them have stakes. Some people say Pakistan has the biggest influence in this situation, since now it's a known fact the leadership of Taliban live in Pakistan, their families are here, their businesses are here. Why isn't Pakistan playing more of a role, not using more of its influence to encourage Taliban?
Pakistan has been using its influence. Pakistan wants to play a peaceful role. Pakistan wants to encourage the people of Afghanistan to come to a solution, to come together.
So what is that role that you talk about that Pakistan sees itself playing in Afghanistan post this withdrawal?
Oh, very important. This is the biggest important, the biggest role which we foresee is rebuilding of Afghanistan. Pakistan is the best, is in the best position to rebuild Afghanistan. We harbored more than 3.5 million refugees. It's a remarkable number. Even today, if you look at Europe, countries are not ready to accept 100 refugees or 1,000 refugees. Pakistan accepted 3.5 million. Pakistan looks forward to a rebuilding for a number of reasons. Actual physical construction in Afghanistan, Pakistan can play a big role. Know-how, Pakistan can play a big role. To lift their educational sector, Pakistan can play a big role. Their health sector, Pakistan play a big role, can play a big role.
What if these intra-Afghan negotiations fail?
Pakistan would not like the talks to fail. Pakistan believes that there are good chances for the talks to be successful.
That was Pakistan President Arif Alvi speaking with VOA's Aisha Tanzeem. Peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government were slated to begin in Turkey this past weekend, but they were canceled after the Islamic militia dismissed the U.S.-promoted conference in Istanbul as a political spectacle serving American interests. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Trade between Cameroon and its landlocked neighbor Chad has come to a virtual standstill, with Chad refusing entry to hundreds of trucks carrying essential supplies for its capital. Chadian military authorities sealed the border last week after the death of longtime President Idriss Deby amid threats from armed rebels. Moki Edwin Kinzika is up next.
Hundreds of trucks with goods meant for Chad's capital, N'Djamena, are sitting idle in Kuseri, a town on Cameroon's northern border with Chad. Another long line of trucks sits and waits on Chadian side of the border. Only a few vehicles said to be transporting humanitarian aid and hospital equipment are being given access to N'Djamena by Chad's border security men. Cameroon's Ministry of Transport says at least 700 trucks bound for Chad's capital have been asked to delay their trips. Nana Seni transports rice from Cameroon's coastal city of Douala to N'Djamena. He says movement between Kuseri and N'Djamena has been halted for about a week now.
Le décès du président chadien, qu'on nous appelons ici midi, est une...
He says traders have been in pain and consternation since last week's death of Idriss Deby. When Deby was alive, he says movement between Kuseri in northern Cameroon and Chad's capital was very fluid and business was thriving. He says Deby's death has brought enormous economic setbacks that may grow worse if the new government in Chad fails to open the border. Landlocked Chad relies on Cameroon for 80% of its imports, while Cameroon buys food staples such as sorghum, onions, and groundnuts from Chad. Zachary Roger Mbarga is a researcher in regional integration and free trade in Central Africa. The University of Yaounde researcher says Chad's military council is preoccupied over the security of the capital. He spoke via telephone from Douala. He says by closing the border, Chad's transitional military council is indicating that its immediate preoccupation is to stop rebels from advancing towards N'Djamena. He says the council wants to secure N'Djamena for the 18 months before examining if it can hand Chad to civilian rule. He says the border closure is already stifling economic liberty and the free movement of people and goods, which are not good signs for a country where people live in poverty. Marsa Success is a Chadian opposition leader. He says security will be threatened in Chad until the Transitional Military Council created after Deby's death hands power to civilians. Massa spoke by telephone from Chad. He says it is high time Chad's military, the civil society and the rebels meet at a dialogue table and immediately hand power to civilian rule. He says Chadians are angry that after Deby's 30 years in power, the military unconstitutionally decided to hand Chad to General Mahamat Idris Deby, the 37-year-old son of the former leader. He says a majority of Chad citizens are disgruntled with the confiscation of power by Deby and his family. He says civilians are ready to sacrifice to free their country even if they go hungry because of the border closure. On Sunday, Chad's ruling military council, in a statement read on state TV, said it will not negotiate with rebels whom they accuse of killing Deby. The military said Mahamat Mahdi Ali, the leader of the rebels, known as the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, had fled into Niger and asked its neighbor to help track Ali down. The council has promised to fully reopen the border in the days ahead if the security situation improves. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Kuseri, Northern Cameroon.
Soldiers angry at the president's extended stay in power have taken up key positions across Somalia's tense capital, but there is none of the gunfire that shattered the previous night in Mogadishu. Soldiers have stationed themselves at key intersections of the city with truck-mounted machine guns. The prime minister has called for a ceasefire and an emergency meeting to discuss the country's security. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called the ongoing surge of coronavirus cases in India heartbreaking on Monday.
WHO is doing everything we can, providing critical equipment and supplies, including thousands of oxygen concentrators, prefabricated mobile field hospitals, and laboratory supplies. As I mentioned on Friday, WHO has redeployed more than 2,600 staff to support the response on the ground.
Maria Van Kerkhove, the WHO's technical lead for COVID-19, described the situation.
Almost 5.7 million cases reported last week, and that is certainly an underestimate of the true number of cases of infections that have occurred in the last week. It's a fragile situation globally.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters that the U.S. Department of Defense and USAID are pursuing options to provide oxygen generation systems to India. She also says that it will share up to 60 million doses of the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine with other countries as soon as within the next few weeks. However, AstraZeneca is facing some new trouble, and Reuters' Emily Wither has that part of the story.
The European Commission is launching legal action after AstraZeneca said they were only aiming to deliver a third of the number of COVID-19 vaccines ordered by the EU. All 27 EU states are backing the move, accusing the company of not respecting its contract. Here's the EU Commission spokesman.
What matters to us in this case is that we want to make sure that there is a speedy delivery of a sufficient number of doses that European citizens are entitled to and which have been promised on the basis of the contract.
Under the contract, AstraZeneca had committed to making, quote, its best reasonable efforts to deliver 180 million vaccine doses to the EU in the second quarter of this year. That would make a total of 300 million in the period from December to June. But the company said in a statement on March 12th, it would aim to deliver only one third of that. A week later, the EU Commission sent a legal letter to the company in the first step of a formal procedure to resolve disputes. They accuse AstraZeneca of not having a reliable plan to deliver on time.
Emily Wither reports for Reuters News. With over 30 million infections and nearly 600,000 deaths due to COVID-19, the United States has been among the hardest hit nations in the world. However, per capita rates of infection and death from the coronavirus have not been shared equally among racial and ethnic groups in America. Indeed, since the pandemic began in early 2020, African Americans and other minorities have been far more likely than white Americans to become ill and die from the disease. Many factors explain this, including poverty, poor access to top-notch and affordable health care, and higher levels of in-person employment in restaurants and factories among minority populations. Now, to find out more about the issues of equity and inclusion in American public health, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Monica Webb-Hopper, Deputy Director of the National Institute on Health and Health Disparities at the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C. She began their conversation by outlining the scientific focus of her agency's work.
The populations that we focus on are racial and ethnic minoritized populations, populations with less socioeconomic privilege or less money, less education, and those who are often discriminated against or excluded. And we are focused on improving minority health and reducing these disparities in population subgroups.
And how do you do that?
One way we do that is first understanding what disparities exist. So we have to collect data for helping us track and monitor disparities over time. That's the only way we would know if disparities are closing, if the gaps are widening, and those are points of intervention. Once we identify specific health disparities, we focus on how do we reduce those so that everyone has the optimal chance to have good health.
The current pandemic must have given you lots of material to work with.
Yes. And the data tell us that individuals who are considered racial and ethnic minorities have higher rates of cases of COVID-19, more likely to be in the hospital, and more likely to die compared to the majority population, white individuals who are not Hispanic or Latino.
What are the common features of the disparities you've identified?
They really come down to a few buckets. They are related to health and healthcare differences, those with less money, less health insurance, and who are largely racial ethnic minority. And then also socioeconomics are a big part of that, which includes, you know, having access to employment that would provide you, for instance, with the opportunity to work from home and to have a computer at home and internet access. So the things that provide you with the ability to avoid being exposed to COVID-19.
What's one typical example of that?
Let's take a warehouse, for instance, where there are low-wage workers who are exposed, who don't have proper hand-washing stations and sanitizing materials, and they don't have masks. And so they're in this environment working with lots of other people and lots of opportunity to be exposed to COVID-19, and the organization doesn't prioritize that. And by getting that data in hand, you have an opportunity to develop strategies to change these systems and move us toward everyone having good health.
You said there are deeper, more fundamental factors at work here.
We can't ignore the kind of backdrop of just structural inequities.
Meaning?
Injustices, things that are not fair.
Do you think that maybe people in the mainstream, including policymakers, simply may not care if minorities sometimes get left out of the health equation?
You know, I'd like to believe, and I do believe, that most people are good and that most people believe in fairness and injustice and access to high quality health care for everyone. I do, however, think that these unfair aspects are just baked into the system. So they almost become invisible unless you're really looking for them or unless you're directly affected by them. That's why it's really important for us to talk about these issues, because that's our only opportunity for these systems to change.
Of course, equity sounds like a great idea, but what practical difference does the idea make?
It's more than an idea. COVID-19 has opened up conversations about this topic in a way that I've never observed. And while we have the world's attention on health disparities and the poor health received by certain groups, we have to capitalize on this moment. If we don't, we risk it only remaining an aspiration. And I think that from the NIH perspective, as we work with scientists, we generate the science, the data needed to help make those changes possible. Putting the science behind these concepts, because believe it or not, there are many people who never thought about this and who don't believe it's real. And even to begin to convince them, we need hardcore, indisputable data. So we've got work to do.
That was the Deputy Director of the National Institute on Health and Health Disparities at the National Institutes of Health Monica Webb Hopper, speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Russian authorities ordered all offices of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny closed Monday as a court reviews a request from state prosecutors to label his anti-corruption foundation as an extremist group. Labeling the group extremist would give Russian authorities more freedom to arrest and freeze assets of those associated with Navalny, the most high-profile opponent of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Members of the group wrote on social media Monday that following the order, it will be too dangerous for them to continue working, but they would continue to oppose Putin in a personal capacity. State prosecutors have said the group threatens to undermine the stability of the country. Navalny, a 44-year-old Kremlin critic, has been detained since January in a high-security prison under conditions that may amount to torture, according to the United Nations. Navalny has accused Putin of ordering Russia's security services to poison him, a charge that the Kremlin has repeatedly denied. Several European laboratories have confirmed that Navalny was poisoned by Novichok, a nerve agent developed by the former Soviet Union. Australian activists hope that the George Floyd murder conviction in the United States will prompt action to cut the number of indigenous deaths in police custody. Phil Mercer reports that at least 450 first Australians have died in detention since a powerful royal commission investigated the problem in 1991.
We can't breathe!
Murder 14,000 kilometers away in the United States prompted protests last year in Australia. George Floyd's death highlighted the mistreatment of Indigenous people within the justice system. Australia's original inhabitants have been incarcerated at 13 times the rate of non-Aboriginal people. They have a greater risk of dying in custody than other prisoners. Ronnie Gorey, a former police officer, is optimistic that change is on its way.
It took the death of a black man, George Floyd, for Australia to stand up and listen and pay attention. And what they don't realise is these deaths that has been occurring in our country for centuries.
In 1991, a royal commission looking into Aboriginal deaths in custody made more than 300 recommendations across broad areas of policy, including improving the way First Nation communities interacted with the police and courts. A review in 2018 for the Prime Minister's department in Canberra found that more than 90% of the Commission's recommendations had been fully or partly implemented. Since then, though, at least 450 Indigenous prisoners have died in custody. Tony McAvoy, who was Australia's first Indigenous senior counsel or senior barrister, says Indigenous communities simply don't trust the legal system.
We have to ask, are there things occurring and in which there are police cover-ups? They have no faith that the system is being truthful in how it's dealing with our interactions with the legal system and, in particular, deaths in custody.
Later this year, two serving Australian police officers will face trials for murder over the deaths of Aboriginal prisoners. They both deny the charges. Indigenous Australians are among the most incarcerated people in the world. They make up about 3% of the national population and suffer disproportionately high rates of poverty, ill health, and unemployment. Australia's federal, state, and territory governments have joined the National Closing the Gap program that aims to improve education, employment, and well-being in Indigenous communities. A key aim of the plan is to reduce the number of Aboriginal children in detention by 30% by 2031. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, the footwear industry is one of the fastest emerging businesses opportunities in Africa. Footwear analysts say that the continent is endowed with raw materials, impressive talent, and affordable labor, giving it the edge to build a multi-billion-dollar industry. Now, for more perspective, Africa 54's technology correspondent Paula Ndiho spoke via Skype to Chidinma Imodi Chukwuemeka, co-founder of the Footwear Academy in Aba State, Nigeria.
Okay, the Footwear Academy is a hub here in Abia State, Aba. We help young people to produce export standard footwear products. We offer trainings. We have a shared / co-working space for shoemakers, and we help them access like affordable raw materials and machines, and also offer job matching opportunities for shoemakers. Yeah.
How did you get started?
We got started in 2017. We wanted to formalize the footwear training system here in Nigeria. Usually, people would learn shoemaking through the apprenticeship system. So you would find like a shoemaker and go through an apprenticeship system that would typically last for like 5 to 10 years. And the unfortunate thing about it was that mostly excluded women. So women couldn't access shoemaking, and it was something that we wanted to correct. We wanted to make people, especially young people, find the vocation interesting. We wanted to offer like a support system to enable them to learn, not only learn, to also earn as shoemakers. And I wanted more women to be included in the industry here in Nigeria. So we took the shoemaking, we made it easier, we made it fun, made it easy and accessible to young people.
Talk to me about the process. How do you make these shoes?
So we manufacture our shoes ourselves. Under the academy, aside from the training that we offer, we also have like a brand name called Bold Step by TFA. Yes, so we buy our materials. We have some materials that are locally manufactured here. We have some of them that are imported from Europe. We make our shoes from scratch. Customers typically send us designs, and we produce that design.
What type of shoes do you make?
We make dress shoes, some casual, but most of our Bold Step is actually a men fashion brand, and so we make for mostly men dress shoes and a bit of casual shoes.
The footwear industry is dominated by a lot of men. As a young person, a young woman in this business, how has it been like for you?
It has its ups and downs. It wasn't easy. It's still not easy because, you know, even in the men, even in the association that you have to join, you're mostly men, and there's not a lot of acceptance of a woman coming in as a shoemaker. So even though that has changed in recent times, but it also helps that I'm also in business with my husband, who's also my co-founder. So in situations where I would have faced, if I'm being discriminated, you know, we would position him to, you know, handle that situation, which is really unfortunate and sad, but, you know, we just have to find a way to still do business. So that's what has helped us really.
When I was doing my research about you, I learned that you are one of those very few people who are giving the men that you're talking about a run for their money. What is it that you're doing differently? What's so unique about your products?
Our products are really, you know, well done. We consider a lot of factors before producing a pair of shoes. We'll rather trash a pair of shoes than ship it off to a customer if it's top standard. So we put in a lot of work because in Nigeria, we used to have, Aba used to be known for substandard products. So people would naturally say, oh, it's from Aba. And then people would think, oh, okay, that means it's substandard. So when we moved here in 2018, we started changing the narrative. So we produce our shoes, we market it and say it's made in Aba, and then people look at it and be like, wow, this was made not only in Nigeria, it was made in Aba. So we used the hashtag, because the competition we won from Ford Foundation is called Proudly Made in Aba Hackathon. And so when we moved here, we started marketing rights in our shoes as proudly made in Aba.
Kidima, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.